Hello, radio readers, and welcome to The Book Report, a new show all about books. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today I'm inviting you to spend an hour with me and my guests as we explore what to read and what's coming on the horizon. We're going to delve deep into our passionate pastime. Every week at this time, you'll hear authors interviewed and authors reading their own works. Soon, we'll give you, our listeners, the chance to be a book reviewer here on this show. And I hope you and all your book club colleagues will join in the fun. Today, we've got a very special program for you. We're going to spotlight the upcoming Miami Book Fair International. Yes, my hometown is the site of the nation's largest literary festival. Did you realize that? The New York Times calls the Miami Book Fair, and I quote, the model for all book festivals. The fair kicks off its 27th year in downtown Miami on November 14th and culminates in a massive street fair with more than 200 exhibitors from Friday to Sunday, November 19th to 21st. Who is coming, you ask? Listeners, it's a veritable who's who of all of your favorites. Pat Conroy, Dave Barry, Nora Ephron, Jonathan Franzen, Brad Meltzer, Salman Rushdie, and I'm not even scratching the surface here. You'll find a complete list of authors, talks, panels, discussions, special evenings, and everything you need to know about planning your visit at www.miamibookfair.com. You'll be hearing my conversations with many of these authors on upcoming shows. So, are you, like me, wondering about the evolution of this major literary event? Readers, it is my great pleasure to introduce Mitchell Kaplan to you. He is a co-founder and a principal architect of the Miami Book Fair International, and he now serves as the chairperson on its board of directors. Mitchell is a Miami native who started his career as a high school English teacher. He then became a pioneer in the independent bookselling business, creating what is now the favorite destination for Florida bibliophiles, Books and Books. The store has grown to 6 locations, including one branch at the Miami International Airport, one in the Cayman Islands, and one in West Hampton Beach. As I said, Mitchell has been a part of the fair from its inceptions. Let's let him tell us all about it. Welcome, Mitchell.
It's great to be here and to be on the radio with you.
I wanted to get right into the fair, and in looking up the history of the fair, I saw you in a 1984 photograph of the first official ribbon-cutting ceremony. Can you tell us how the fair got started, who brought the group together, and what were your goals?
Well, I was much younger back then and had just opened Books and Books 2 years before. And I had been to a number of different citywide book festivals. There was one in New York at the time and one in Boston. Those two don't exist anymore, but I had been to them, and it was always in the back of my mind that a book festival would really be something very special for Miami. And at the same time, a number of other people had thought the very same thing, including Eduardo Padron, who at the time was the president of the Wolfson campus of Miami-Dade College. And Eduardo had been to Barcelona and had been at the Barcelona Book Fair. So we thought, you know, that maybe what we would try to do is bring a big book festival to downtown Miami, because many of your listeners might not know, but Miami back in those days was suffering greatly. The Mariel boat lift had happened just a couple years before. Economically, it was extremely depressed. It was just at the beginning of the whole cocaine cowboys time. Didn't really even benefit from Miami Vice. That hadn't happened. Models and photographers didn't discover South Beach. It was crumbling. So we really felt that we would try to do something good for the city, something that would tie the whole city together and make it feel very good about itself. So we did that. We brought it to downtown Miami, created the very first Miami Book Fair. And from the beginning, we had a vision that the city would support it, and it certainly has.
Looking back, can you share some moments you'll never forget?
You know, at our 25th Miami Book Fair, I literally went through every single guide to look at every single author who came. And over the 25 years, we probably presented close to 6,000-7,000 authors. And the thing that I always remember and the thing that I look back on are those authors who are no longer with us. And there are quite a few of them. At the very first Miami Book Fair, we had the honor of presenting James Baldwin, quite a distinguished American writer. I recall, it was very interesting, Mario Vargas Llosa won the Nobel Prize this year, and Mario had been to a number of fairs very early on. And as a young bookseller, it was really exciting to be able to understand the connections between writers. For instance, we also had Allen Ginsberg, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, and Allen Ginsberg came to a fair, and Mario Vargas Llosa was scheduled to be at the same fair. And if you just look on the face of it, the two of them would seem maybe quite different from one another. But I walked into the hotel with Allen Ginsberg, and Mario Vargas Llosa was coming toward us. And I was wondering what that interaction would be. And then, lo and behold, they gave each other big hugs and kisses, and they had been very good friends. And I never would have imagined that someone as patrician and as academic as Mario would be so close friends with someone who was, so emblematic of the Beat Generation. So, the intricacies of this fair and the intricacies of literary culture, which has been celebrated for so many years, those are the kinds of things that I remember. Lots of, having Czesław Miłosz, the Nobel Prize-winning poet, give a reading, a very, very interesting reading, where he wrote a poem for his wife that had never been read before, and he read that to end his reading. Or even Garrison Keillor, at the height of his popularity, when he was on the cover of Newsweek in the 80s, the mid-80s, he led the whole audience in a rendition of Amazing Grace. And here you had 600-700 people all singing together. So there are those moments that will stay with me my whole life.
You have such a great mix of authors, from the great thinkers of today to pop icons. How have you been able, for the past 27 years, to put together such a balanced list of authors where everyone, readers and non-readers alike, can find things that will appeal to them?
Well, Miami, as I said, in the very early days, was looked at as a kind of limited place. The very first year that I would request authors, publishers would often get back to me and say, look, you got a lot of old people down there. Well, we have all these non-prescription drug books. And they would try to send authors who were the authors of those books. Or they thought it was just, light beach reading that was going on here. And I think what we've managed to do is celebrate this diversity, which is Miami. And the Miami Book Fair is a very large tent under which the whole community comes together. And crucial to making that happen is having a very varied program. So as the reputation of the fair has grown, more and more writers want to come to the Miami Book Fair. It's seen as one of the premier literary events around. So it becomes easier and easier to get them. And I guess as a bookseller, my area has always been a lot of the programming. And as a bookseller, I'm very close to the ground in terms of, what books people are reading and the kinds of interests they might have. So, it's part of the art of the fair. It's a lot of fun to work with a committee to put this together. But it's the one thing that we're also very proud of.
Well, since we have listeners from across the country, take a moment to convince them why they should hop on a plane and be a part of this year's fair.
Well, depending on where you are, November in Miami is about one of the more beautiful times to be coming down. And not only that, if you're a book lover, if you're a reader, to marry that with, the wonderful architecture down here, South Beach, Little Haiti, Little Havana, and then to be able to hear writers like Carlos Fuentes or Patti Smith or Eugene Robinson. We also have Jonathan Franzen coming. We've got just a whole host of marvelous people that you can experience in a very up-close and personal way. Dave Eggers will be here for the first time. We've got cooking demonstrations and cooking authors like Joan Nathan. We have the Rock Bottom Remainders who play. They'll have a musical performance with Scott Turow, Dave Barry, Carl Hyacin. Then there's also our international pavilion that we're focusing on Mexico this year. There's just so many different things to be able to do here at the fair that if you're a book lover, it's a great way to marry a vacation and layer a vacation onto something that's so enriching.
And how can you explain the phenomenal growth of the fair? Is this the dawn of a new literary age?
Well, it depends what, you know, the dawn. I mean, we're talking 27 years, so it's a very long dawn. You know, what I think is really true is that there is something very, very essential about literary culture that will not be thwarted or blunted given our transition to screens. There's still something extremely low-tech and extremely, you know, as I say, essential about coming, listening to an author read or talk, meeting that author, asking that author questions. You know, there's nothing like actually being there. It doesn't happen on the internet. It happens live and in person. And I think people like that kind of interaction.
Well, thank you so much, Mitchell. I know I'll be there almost every minute. The Miami Book Fair, November 14th through the 21st. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
I'm really looking forward to the book fair. It's such a great experience to go from readings to Q&A sessions with some of the biggest names writing today. Then you're off to intimate discussions with poets and other writers who have smaller but very devoted followings. Readers, as a warm-up for the fair, this week we're going to listen to works by some of the authors who will actually be there, speaking, signing, and interacting with readers like you. Let's start with Salman Rushdie. I've read several of his books. Didn't all of us read, or say we read, Satanic Verses? But I have to say, this one, Shalimar the Clown, is one of my favorites. For me, this story is really accessible. It delves into the murder of Maximilian Ophuls, a former U.S. ambassador to India. The assassin was his own limo driver, a Kashmiri Muslim, a mystery man who calls himself Shalimar the Clown. Was it a political killing, or was it the woman who crossed both men's lives? Shalimar the Clown is a history of betrayal and deception that moves from World War II Europe to the troubled Kashmir region to contemporary America. Rushdie weaves a series of interconnected narratives to form a sweeping tale, at once timeless and modern. Here is Salman Rushdie's Shalimar the Clown, read by Asif Mandvi. Yes, the Asif Mandvi who you may know from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
She trembled before her mother's absence, a void sentinel shape in the dark, and waited for the second calamity, waited without knowing she was waiting. After her father died, her brilliant, cosmopolitan father, Franco-American, like liberty, he said, her beloved, resented, wayward, promiscuous, often absent, irresistible father, she began to sleep soundly, as if she had been shriven, forgiven her sins, or perhaps his. The burden of sin had been passed on. She did not believe in sin. So until her father's death, she was not an easy woman to sleep with, though she was a woman with whom men wanted to sleep. The pressure of men's desires was tiresome to her. The pressure of her own desires was, for the most part, unrelieved. The few lovers she took were variously unsatisfactory, and so, as if to declare the subject closed, she soon enough settled on one pretty average fellow, and even gave serious consideration to his proposal of marriage. Then the ambassador was slaughtered on her doorstep, like a halal chicken dinner, bleeding to death from a deep neck wound caused by a single slash of the assassin's blade. In broad daylight, how the weapon must have glistened in the golden morning sun, which was the city's quotidian blessing, or its curse. The daughter of the murdered man was a woman who hated good weather, but most of the year the city offered little else. Accordingly, she had to put up with long, monotonous months of shadowless sunshine and dry, skin-cracking heat. On those rare mornings when she awoke to cloud cover and a hint of moisture in the air, she stretched sleepily in bed, arching her back, and was briefly, even hopefully, glad. But the clouds invariably burned off by noon, and then there it was again. The dishonest nursery blue of the sky that made the world look childlike and pure. The loud, impolite orb blaring at her like a man laughing too loudly in a restaurant. In such a city there could be no gray areas, or so it seemed. Things were what they were and nothing else. Unambiguous, lacking the subtleties of drizzle, shade, and chill. Under the scrutiny of such a sun, there was no place to hide. People were everywhere on display, their bodies shining in the sunlight, scantily clothed, reminding her of advertisements. No mysteries here or depths, only surfaces and revelations.
What happens when you realize life isn't living up to your expectations? Jonathan Franzen, author of the wildly popular The Corrections, writes a darkly comedic exploration of contemporary family life. Freedom tells the tale of Patty and Walter Berglund, the new pioneers of Old St. Paul, the gentrifiers, the avant-garde of the Whole Foods generation, the couple who are always doing their part to make this world a better place. But then, things begin to get a bit strange. The perfect family facade starts to crumble. Why? Franzen explores today's family in a tone at once comic and tragic. Everything from the onset of teenage lust to the inevitable compromises of middle age. Let's hear a bit of Freedom Now, narrated by David Ledoux.
There were also more contemporary questions like, what about those cloth diapers? Worth the bother? And was it true that you could still get milk delivered in glass bottles? Were the Boy Scouts okay politically? Was Bulgur really necessary? Where to recycle batteries? How to respond when a poor person of color accused you of destroying her neighborhood? Was it true that the glaze of old Fiesta ware contained dangerous amounts of lead? How elaborate did a kitchen water filter actually need to be? Did your 240 sometimes not go into overdrive when you pushed the overdrive button? Was it better to offer panhandlers food or nothing? Was it possible to raise unprecedentedly confident, happy, brilliant kids while working full-time? Could coffee beans be ground the night before you used them, or did this have to be done in the morning? Had anybody in the history of St. Paul ever had a positive experience with a roofer? What about a good Volvo mechanic? Did your 240 have that problem with the sticky parking brake cable? And that enigmatically labeled dashboard switch that made such a satisfying Swedish click but seemed not to be connected to anything. What was that? For all queries, Patty Berglund was a resource, a sunny carrier of socio-cultural pollen, an affable bee. She was one of the few stay-at-home moms in Ramsey Hill and was famously averse to speaking well of herself or ill of anybody else. She said she expected to be beheaded someday by one of the windows whose sash chains she'd replaced. Her children were probably dying of trichinosis from pork she'd undercooked. She wondered if her addiction to paint stripper fumes might be related to her never reading books anymore. She confided that she'd been forbidden to fertilize Walter's flowers after what had happened last time. There were people with whom her style of self-deprecation didn't sit well, who detected a kind of condescension in it, as if Patty, in exaggerating her own minor defects, were too obviously trying to spare the feelings of less accomplished homemakers. But most people found her humility sincere, or at least amusing, and it was in any case hard to resist a woman whom your own children liked so much, and who remembered not only their birthdays, but yours too, and came to your back door with a plate of cookies, or a card, or some lilies of the valley, and a little thrift store vase that she told you not to bother returning. It was known that Patty had grown up back east, in a suburb of New York City, and had received one of the first women's full scholarships to play basketball at Minnesota, where, in her sophomore year, according to a plaque on the wall of Walter's home office, she'd made second-team All-American. One strange thing about Patty, given her strong family orientation, was that she had no discernible connection to her roots. Whole seasons passed without her setting foot outside St. Paul, and it wasn't clear that anybody from the East, not even her parents, had ever come out to visit. If you inquired point blank about the parents, she would answer that the two of them did a lot of good things for a lot of people. Her dad had a law practice in White Plains. Her mom was a politician. Yeah, the New York State Assemblywoman. Then she would nod emphatically and say, "Yeah, so that's what they do," as if the topic had been exhausted. A game could be made of trying to get Patty to agree that somebody's behavior was bad. When she was told that Seth and Mary Paulson were throwing a big Halloween party for their twins and had deliberately invited every child on the block, except Connie Monahan, Patty would only say that this was very weird. The next time she saw the Paulsons in the street, they explained that they had tried all summer to get Connie Monahan's mother, Carol, to stop flicking cigarette butts from her bedroom window down into their twins' little wading pool. "That is really weird," Patty agreed, shaking her head. "But, you know, it's not Connie's fault." The Paulsons, however, refused to be satisfied with weird. They wanted sociopathic. They wanted passive-aggressive. They wanted bad.
Ever since James Bond drove up in his Aston Martin, we've been held captive by secret agents. Now, in Intelligence, a darkly humorous debut novel by a former CIA agent, Susan Hassler, you're going to uncover a story that scares the daylights out of you, just as it makes you smile. Agent Maddie James and her colleagues are terrorism experts working in a crumbling intelligence agency. But before they can tackle the war on terrorism, they must take on office politics, government cover-ups, and blackmail. And now, for your ears only, as only a former spy could write it, Intelligence by Susan Hassler.
The door bangs into my chair, but I've lost the ability to scream since the stadium attack. I expect to see Harry, but it is the other person who never bothers to knock. My mother.
Madeline, you haven't returned any of my phone calls. I was starting to wonder if you had collapsed. Have you eaten today?
Yes, I say. I ate a good lunch.
2 pecan tarts,
Vivi says. Snitch.
I knew it. Well, I'm going to fix that. I took the day off again, and I've been cooking and baking all morning. I brought enough for everybody.
You are so good to us, Mrs. James,
Vivi says. For some odd reason, all of my colleagues call my mother Mrs. James, even though every other person in the mines goes by his or her first name.
We are most grateful for the excellent comestibles,
Doc says. My mother beams as she pulls a cart as far into the room as it will go and begins to unload foil-covered casseroles and platters. These are passed directly over my head to the waiting arms of my colleagues, who push aside stacks of papers and other debris to make room for the feast. When everything is unloaded, my mother hands out wet wipes and little packages of plastic cutlery.
You folks eat. You need to keep up your strength. I'll be back for your dishes later.
Mom kisses the top of my head and exits with her cart. A second later, she's back.
I almost forgot to give you the condiments.
She sets down a wooden condiment caddy, painted with pink bunny rabbits. The door closes again. Vernon raises the foil on one of the casseroles.
Does your mother have some sort of lima bean fetish?
He says. It's a southern thing, I say. Eat it and don't complain.
What's this?
Kristen asks as she lifts the foil on another casserole. Cheesy hominy bake. Kristen looks doubtful.
Explain hominy to me again. Is it a carb?
Just eat it, I snap. Eat it all, or she'll interrogate me on what was wrong with it. My colleagues exchange looks and dutifully dig in.
I love southern cooking,
Bonnie says, as she spoons out a large dollop of cheesy hominy bake.
I appreciate your mother, even if you don't.
Don't appreciate her too much, or the opposite sides of this table will have to take turns inhaling,
Vernon says. A minute later, the door bangs into my chair again. I don't flinch. Yes, Mom, I say, without turning around.
Madeline, I forgot to ask you. When will you be home tonight? Late?
Yes, late. Probably very late. Very, very late.
Okay. I won't bother you again until you all are finished. Bon appetit.
Thank you, Mrs. James.
I have nothing to live for. Nothing. Life is one big sucking, stinking morass. One humongous intelligence failure of historic proportions. No love life, no outside life. Career down the toilet. Vivi tries to pass me a platter of country ham, but I wave it away.
Come on, Maddie, eat something. Your mother was so sweet to do this. The ham is a little salty, but there are biscuits to put it on.
If we have to ingest all of these carbs, not to mention the saturated fat and sodium, then you should too,
Kristen says. Pass me a brownie.
Walter Mosley and his new hero, Leonid McGill, are back in Known to Evil. Just like Mosley's beloved Easy Rollins series, Leonid is quite the character. Like, just how did he get that Soviet communist name? You'll see. Known to Evil dives headlong into gritty, glittery, contemporary Manhattan, making the city pulse in a whole new way. Readers get to know McGill, a PI who describes himself as going from crooked to slightly bent. Let's investigate Known to Evil, read by Miran Willis.
Don't you like the food? Katrina, my wife of 23 years, asked. It's delicious, I said. Whatever you make is always great. In the corner, there sat a walnut cabinet that used to contain our first stereo record player. Now it held Katrina's cherished Blue Danube china collection, which she inherited from her favorite aunt Brigitte. On top of the chest was an old quart pickle jar, the makeshift vase for an arrangement of tiny wildflowers of every color from scarlet to cornflower blue to white. But you're frowning, my beautiful Scandinavian wife said. What are you thinking about? I looked up from the filet mignon and gorgonzola blue cheese salad to gaze at the flowers. My thoughts were not the kind of dinner conversation one had with one's wife and family. I have a boyfriend now, Aura Ullman had told me that morning. I wanted to tell you. I didn't want to feel like I'm hiding anything from you. Where'd you get those flowers, Mom? Shelley asked. His name is George, Aura told me, the sad empathy in the words making its way to her face. I had no reason to be jealous. Aura and I have been lovers over the 8 months Katrina abandoned me for the investment banker, Andre Zuhl. I loved Aura, but gave her up because when Katrina came back, after Andre was indicted for fraud, I felt that she, Katrina, was my sentence for the wrong I had done in a long life of crime. I saw them at the deli and thought they might brighten up our dinner, Katrina told her daughter. Shelley had been trying to forgive her mother for leaving me. She was a sophomore at CCNY and another man's daughter, though she didn't know it. Two of my children were fathered out of wedlock. Only the eldest, sour and taciturn Dimitri, who always sat as far away from me as possible, was of my blood. Do you love him? I had meant to ask Aura that. I didn't want to know the answer, or to show vulnerability. He's very good company, and I get lonely. Well? Katrina asked. Something about those flowers and the echo of Aura's voice in my mind made me want to curse, or maybe to slam my fist down on the plate. Hey, everybody, Twill said. He was standing in the doorway to the dining room, dark and slender, handsome and flawless, except for a small crescent scar on his chin. You're late, Katrina scolded my favorite. You know it, Moms, the 17-year-old man replied. I'm lucky to get home at all with everything I got to do. My P.O. got me working this after-school job at the supermarket. Says it'll keep me out of trouble. He's not a parole officer. He's a juvenile offender social worker, I said. Just seeing Twill brought levity into the room. It's not a he, Twill said as he slid into the chair next to me.
Two Capitol Hill staffers, Matthew Mercer and Harris Sandler, are playing a mysterious game. It's a game almost no one knows about, not their friends, not their co-workers, and not their bosses, who are some of the most powerful senators and congressmen on Capitol Hill. It's a game that has everything. Risk, reward, mystery, and the thrill of knowing that, just by being invited to play, you've confirmed your status as a true power broker in D.C. But as Matthew and Harris quickly discover, the Zero Game is hiding a secret so explosive that it will shake Washington to its core. And when someone close to them winds up dead, Harris and Matthew realize that this game is far more sinister than they had imagined. As the bullseye turns their way, it's clear they're about to become the game's next victim. Readers, I love this one from Meltzer, because as a grad student, I worked on Capitol Hill, too. So get ready for octane suspense and heart-pounding action. The Zero Game, read by Scott Brick.
Dean of the House and Congress's longest-serving member. Over the years, he's seen everything from desegregation and the Red Scare to Vietnam and Watergate to Lewinsky and Iraq. But as he hangs his jacket on the hand-carved coat rack and rushes toward the wooden stall in back, he doesn't see us. And as we zip up our flies, Harris and I barely make an attempt to see him. That's my point, I whisper to Harris. What, him? He whispers back, motioning to Enemark's stall. The guy's a living legend, Harris. You know how jaded we must be to let him walk by without saying hello? He's going to the can. You can still say hello, right? Harris makes a face, then motions over to LaRue, who raises the volume on C-SPAN. Whatever Harris is about to say, he doesn't want it heard. Matthew, I hate to break it to you, but the only reason you didn't throw him a high, Congressman, is because you think his environmental record is crap. It's hard to argue with that. Last year, Enemark was the number one recipient of campaign money from the timber, oil, and nuclear power industries. He'd clear-cut Oregon, hang billboards in the Grand Canyon, and vote to pave over his own garden with baby seal skins if he thought it'd get him some cash. But even so, if I were a 22-year-old just out of college, I still would have stuck my hand out for a quick hi, Congressman. I'm telling you, Harris, 8 years is enough. The fun's long gone. still standing at the urinal. Harris stops. His green eyes narrow, and he studies me with that same mischievous look that once got me thrown in the back of a police car when we were undergrads at Duke. Come on, Matthew. This is Washington, D.C. Fun and games are being played everywhere, he teases. You just have to know where to find them. Before I can react, his hand springs out and grabs the Lorax pin from my lapel. He glances at LaRue, then over to the congressman's jacket on a coat rack. What are you doing? Cheering you up, he promises. Trust me, he'll love it. No lie. There it is. No lie. Harris's favorite turn of phrase, and the first sign of guaranteed trouble. I flush my urinal with my elbow. Harris flushes his with a full-on grip. He's never been afraid to get his hands dirty. How much will you give me if I put it on his lapel, he whispers, holding up the Lorax and moving toward Anamark's coat. Harris, don't, I hiss. He'll kill you. Wanna bet? There's a hollow rumble of spinning toilet paper from within the stall. Anamark's almost finished. As Harris shoots me a smile, I reach for his arm, but he sidesteps my grip with his usual perfect grace. It's how he operates in every political fight. Once he's focused on a goal, the man's unstoppable. I am the Lorax, Matthew. I speak for the trees. He laughs as he says the words. Watching him slowly tiptoe toward Enemark's jacket, I can't help but laugh with him. It's a dumb stunt, but if he pulls it off... I take that back. Harris doesn't fail at anything. That's why, at 29 years old, he was one of the youngest chiefs of staff ever hired by a senator. And why, at 35, there's no one, not even the older guys, who can touch him. I swear, he could charge for some of the stuff that comes out of his mouth. Lucky me, old college friends get it for free. How's the weather look, LaRue? Harris calls to Mr. Shoeshine, who, from his seat near the tiled floor, has a better view of what's happening under the stall. If it were anyone else, LaRue would tattle and run. But it isn't anyone else. It's Harris. Bright and sunny, LaRue says as he ducks his head down toward the stall. Though a storm's quickly approaching. Harris nods a thank you and straightens his red tie, which I know he bought from the guy who sells them outside the subway. As chief of staff for Senator Paul Stevens, he should be wearing something nicer. But the way Harris works, he doesn't need to impress. By the way, LaRue, what happened to your mustache? Wife didn't like it. Said it was too Burt Reynolds. I told you, you can't have the mustache and the Trans Am. It's one or the other, Harris adds. LaRue laughs, and I shake my head. When the Founding Fathers set up the government, they split the legislative branch into two sides, the House and the Senate. I'm here in the House, which is in the south half of the Capitol. Harris works in the Senate, which is all the way over on the north. It's a whole different world over there, but somehow... Harris still remembers the latest update on our shoeshine guy's facial hair. I don't know why I'm surprised. Unlike the monsters who walk these halls, Harris doesn't talk to everyone as a political maneuver. He does it because that's his gift. As the son of a barber, he's got the gift of gab. And people love him for it. That's why when he walks into a room, senators casually flock around him, and when he walks into the cafeteria, the lunch lady gives him an extra ladle of chicken in his burrito. Reaching Enemark's gray suit jacket, Harris pulls it from the coat rack and fishes for the lapel. The toilet flushes behind us. We all spin back toward the stall. Harris is still holding the jacket. Before any of us can react, the door to the stall swings open. If we were brand new staffers, this is where we'd panic. Instead, I bite the inside of my cheek and take a deep gulp of Harris's calm.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral, We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Kendall Coffey is a former U.S. attorney, Southern District of Florida, who headed the largest prosecutor's office in America. He is currently a partner at Coffey Burlington PL, concentrating on complex litigation. Mr. Coffey has provided legal commentary for The Today Show, Larry King Live, Good Morning America, Anderson Cooper, and CNN Headline News, to name a few. Mr. Coffey has been involved in many high-profile cases. Those are the front page ones you've read over the years, including Elian Gonzalez, Scott Rothstein, and the hanging chads of the 2000 election. Now Mr. Coffey puts pen to paper and delivers Spinning the Law, Trying Cases in the Court of Public Opinion. To quote Alan Dershowitz, who wrote the foreword to the book, clients, whether civil or criminal, are increasingly brought to trial not only before a judge in robes, but also in the court of public opinion, where every citizen gets to cast a vote. Law and order fans, take note. This is an unusual look at the complex relationship of clients, oftentimes who are celebrities, their lawyers, and the press. Welcome, Kendall. Thanks so much for being here today.
Hey, thanks, Elaine. This is terrific.
First and foremost, tell our listeners why this book is not just a good read for those in the legal profession.
Well, it's not written for lawyers, although I think lawyers would enjoy it very, very much. It's written for the people that enjoy watching shows on television about legal cases, that listen to some of us talking heads once in a while, or for anybody that reads with some interest cases about celebrities that get into trouble, and we all know how often that happens. There's a huge fascination with legal cases in America today. And I think anybody who has any interest either in the life trials of the rich and famous, or the interesting cases of the not so rich and famous, or just legal developments in their own hometown would really enjoy this book. I try to make it readable in a couple places where it's appropriate. I try to make it entertaining. It's the kind of book you could read on an airplane or read in your living room.
Well, since you bring up celebrities, I'm going to ask you, do you feel that celebrities get special treatment in the courtroom?
Well, celebrities get the best of times and the worst of times, Elaine, in the justice system. The bad news for celebrities is if you're under the radar or the microscope of law enforcement, they will go behind every blade of grass. They'll look under every rock to try to make a case against a celebrity if they can, because a case involving a famous person becomes a famous case, and that becomes very important for law enforcement and also an opportunity sometimes to send a message. You think of the Martha Stewart case, and it was an opportunity to send a big-time message about things like insider trading, about obstruction. And they consider that. On the other hand, celebrities can hire the best possible lawyers. That's a huge advantage. And I think most of the time that a well-regarded celebrity is going to get a slight break in the way juries react to them. Where celebrities sometimes get a tougher time, it's not so much in front of juries, and juries convict plenty of celebrities, but we can also recall cases. Michael Jackson, I was one of many that predicted he would be convicted on at least some of the charges. O.J. is one of the most spectacular examples of a celebrity who, in the face of a lot of evidence of guilt, got away. But another place where celebrities may or may not do well is all the decisions that are made outside of the courtroom, for example, by prosecutors. And one of the concerns, if you think about the criminal justice system, 90 to 95% of the cases are not decided by a jury. They're decided in plea deals negotiated with a prosecutor. And sometimes celebrities get treated like everybody else. Sometimes they don't, because there can be a lot of press heat saying, this celebrity has to be made an example of. And you can ask Plaxico Burress, the former wide receiver for the New York Giants, who is in jail for at least 2 years for an incident where there was an outcry from the New York media that demanded that he be fully punished for that particular crime.
I see. Back to O.J. And the name of your book, as we know, is Spinning the Law. Do you feel that O.J., the O.J. case, is really the one that started the whole contemporary spin?
Well, there was an O.J. revolution in terms of legal spin. So I think your point is very valid. And what happened is, of course, cases have been fascinating in the court of public opinion for centuries. Very few cases could have possibly been more intensely covered than the kidnapping murder trial of involving Charles Lindbergh's baby. But with O.J., there was not only a fascination with the trial and the players in the courtroom, but there was an immense amount of interest, public interest, in talking about it, in dissecting it, in breaking it down for the public. And I think that took the level of interest in high-profile cases to a brand new dimension. And it has been with us ever since. There, any important legal case, any celebrity legal case, is not only going to be more interesting to the public than ever, but it is going to get a lot more discussion, and the analysis and the spin factor is of greater interest than ever before.
You've got a section in the book entitled A Media Primer for Spinners. So, if spin is successfully used by lawyers, is the result that our legal system is now fatally flawed?
Well, you know, great question. And to some extent, I guess I could be, the book does sort of take a revealing look inside some of the strategies that aren't so obvious, but they're legitimate strategies. And the first order of business is to follow the rules. We have ethical rules. So the second one is to be straight with the media. But if you're a lawyer and your case is getting public attention, and by the way, Elaine, as you know, with radio, with TV, with the profusion of internet media, more cases get talked about than ever before. So there are more examples where lawyers are going to need to pay attention to it. And if your case is getting talked about, whether it's bloggers or cable news, it's in your client's interest to try to level the playing field. When a case is in the court of public opinion, there is no presumption of innocence. The presumption is guilty, right? I mean, you read about charges, you read even about accusations. We all think, it's human nature to think, somebody must have done something wrong here, or they wouldn't be making the accusation, or they wouldn't be bringing the charges. So how do you deal with the fact that somebody is presumed guilty in the court of public opinion? Lawyers today try to level the playing field and use legitimate strategies so that people who are observing that case aren't locking into conclusions that the client is wrong or the client is guilty, whether it's a civil or criminal situation, that at a minimum, that a lawyer who, especially when you're trying to defend somebody, tries to get some messages out there to at least convince the public to have an open mind. You're not going to get an empty mind, but you at least want the public to have an open mind about whether your client is guilty or innocent, whether your client is responsible for millions of damages, whatever the issue may be.
Well, your book starts with a look at the trials of Socrates, Joan of Arc, Oscar Wilde, and, you know, goes through modern day cases. I think your book would be great for a series on TV or a movie. Have you been approached? Are there talks?
No, but I really thought some of the historical cases were fascinating. And in fact, there was a lot of spin. And Socrates may have gotten the benefit of the fact that one of the greatest communicators and commentators of his day was Plato, who wrote very favorable spin. Others at the time may have thought differently. And of course, Joan of Arc was a tragic case, but one where the message from the English who were trying her was to discredit her as a witch, as a heretic. Why? It wasn't anything to do with the merits of guilt or innocence. It was simply to get a message out to the public that, in fact, the English reverses she had started leading the French and chasing the English out of France were due to some kind of witchcraft rather than a legitimate nationalism, which is, of course, what Joan of Arc had been inspiring. So it's been with us forever. It's the high-tech age, and more and more it's media like radio, TV, and the internet. But it has been a part of our history and will become an even greater part of our realities.
Well, that's an interesting answer. I think our readers would like to know, what are your favorite courtroom thrillers? Do you read them when you have spare time on a plane, or?
I do, and I still have, like everybody else, fascination with a great murder case where there's some mystery or some unanswered questions as to who did it. And I also get fascinated, personally with cases that have political dimensions. Because, you know, whether it's recount, which we talk about in the book, or even somebody like Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, convicted of only one of many counts, perhaps winning a partial victory, and we'll never know. You remember all those goofy strategies of his? He was getting on every talk show he could find. And some folks thought it was, you know, his desperate 15 minutes of fame as he was on his way to prison. But there's a part of me that wonders whether he was crazy or crazy like a fox, because by getting himself out there, even with the goofy hair and everything, he was making himself more of a human being. And we'll never know whether that resonated in some way with some of the jurors or not, but whether it's murder trials, corruption trials, recount trials, I have to believe that the court of public opinion does matter. Whether it's a big way or a small way, it somehow is something you always have to account for.
Oh, thanks very much, Kendall. And now you are going to be at the book fair, correct?
I'm very excited about that. I've been a fan of the book fair for all these years. It's a very important institution down here in Florida. And I'm just delighted. I'll be appearing on a panel Sunday afternoon, and really looking forward to it, Elaine.
Oh, thanks so much. And readers, the book is titled Spinning the Law, Trying Cases in the Court of Public Opinion. It's a really interesting read. Thanks so much, Kendall.
Hey, thank you, Elaine.
Okay, readers, let's close with something from a guy I'm honored to call my pal, Dave Barry, who will, of course, be at the Miami Book Fair. I'll Mature When I'm Dead, Dave Barry's Amazing Tales of Adulthood, is a brilliantly funny exploration of the treacherous state of adulthood. Some people may wonder what this subject has to do with Dave Barry, since Dave struggled hard against growing up his entire life. But the result is one of the funniest, warmest, most pitch-perfect books ever on that mystifying territory we call adulthood. In hilarious brand new pieces, Dave tackles everything from fatherhood, new fatherhood, quote, over the next 5 years, you will spend roughly 45 minutes total listening to songs you like and roughly 127,000 hours to songs exploring topics such as how the horn on the bus goes, beep, beep, beep. Gets back to self-image, the battle of the sexes, celebrityhood, technology, and certain unmentionable medical procedures. It is a book of pure delight from the man one newspaper claimed could become the most important American humorist since Mark Twain. Here we go.
Several times a week, after talking with one of these women, my wife delivers a rant. It runs about 75 minutes, including a bathroom break, about how wrong it is that there are all these attractive, smart, funny, middle-aged single women out there, and they can't find a man. My wife has a theory about why this is, namely, men are idiots. My wife believes that men tend to have insanely high physical standards regarding the kind of woman they're willing to settle for. She notes that a middle-aged man can have tarantula-grade nose hair, BO that can cause migrating geese to change course, and enough spare tissue to form a whole new middle-aged man. But this man can still believe that he is physically qualified to date Scarlett Johansson. What's wrong with these men? My wife asked purely rhetorically. Don't they have mirrors? It is true that men can appear to be superficial about what qualities they seek in the opposite sex, as shown in this scientific comparison. What women look for in men: intelligence, kindness, a sense of humor, a stable career, loyalty, honesty, integrity, reliability, a willingness to share the load of parenting and housework, good hygiene, and a reasonable level of physical attractiveness. What men look for in women: gazambas. But does this mean that men are nothing but a bunch of shallow, low-life, sex-obsessed horn dogs? Yes, but men have a solid scientific excuse: biology. As we know from attending high school, the human body is actually made up of trillions of tiny one-celled animals called cells, which clot together to form important organs such as the spleen, the jowls, and the goiter. Every single human cell contains DNA, which is a special molecule that your body leaves behind at crime scenes so the police can identify you. But DNA has another important purpose. It contains your genetic code, which enables you to pass along to future generations your distinguishing characteristics, such as hair color, age, hating the Yankees, etc. There are two crucial facts you need to know about DNA. The first one is, your DNA is in charge. You may think you are in charge, but you are not. Your relationship to your body is the same as the relationship between a coach and a soccer team of four-year-olds. The coach can shout all the instructions he wants about kicking the ball, but if the players prefer to stand around picking their noses, they will stand around picking their noses. Likewise, your body does not do what you want. It does what your DNA wants. This leads us to crucial DNA fact number two. The only thing your DNA thinks about is reproducing itself. Your DNA wants to put its imprint on the entire human race, like the Nike Corporation. This goal is shared by both male and female DNA molecules, but they achieve it in very different ways. To understand the difference, let's consider two DNA samples. The first was taken from a woman. It is the familiar double helix. The second was taken from a man. It is essentially a ping-pong ball. There are subtle differences between these molecules, the main one being that the female DNA is much more complex. The reason is that in order for female DNA to reproduce, the female it occupies, this is crucial, has to have a baby. And even if she starts really early and is a total slut, she can only have a limited number of babies. And even after she has a baby, if she wants her DNA line to continue, she has to nurture that baby until it can survive on its own, which with modern human babies does not happen until they are in their mid-30s. So for human females, reproduction is a very complicated and drawn-out process. It can take her weeks just to find an acceptable maternity bathing suit. Then there's all the paraphernalia she must buy for the baby, the stroller that costs as much as, but is more technologically advanced than, a Toyota Celica, the adorable little teensy baby shoes. Now, a rational person, by which I mean a man, might ask whether the baby really needs all these things, especially the shoes, since the only thing babies do with their feet once they discover them is cram them as far as possible into their mouths. But a rational person is not making these decisions. The woman's DNA is, and it is taking no chances. For whatever chemical reason, it is convinced that the baby needs cute little shoes, so the baby will have cute little shoes, just as the baby's room will have wallpaper festooned with cute little baby animals. If you try to stop a severely pregnant woman from providing these things for her baby, she will crush your skull with a diaper genie.
Okay, Dave, you've done it again. And as Dave himself says, I'm not making this up. To add to the fun of the book fair, Dave's band, the Rock Bottom Remainders, will be playing a free concert at 6 p.m. on Saturday, November 20th. Literary rockers Dave Barry, Sam Barry, Ridley Pearson, Kathy Kamen Goldmark, and Scott Turow will be joined by surprise guests. Irregular members of the band in past years have included Amy Tan, Stephen King, and Barbara Kingsolver, so you never know who's going to show up. By the way, the band raised over $2 million for causes such as Haiti relief, so treat them with respect. The fall weather in Miami is beautiful, so come on down to the Miami International Book Fair, running from November 14th through the 21st. Get all the details at miamibookfair.com. I'll be there chatting with authors as varied as Salman Rushdie and Pat Conroy, so keep tuning in to find out what's on their mind. That's all we have time for today, so thanks for being a radio reader of the Book Report. Let's close with the Rock Bottom Remainders as Dave Barry sings Wild Thing, which is kind of an appropriate song for Dave. I'm Elaine Charles. See you next week.